Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy on KFI is provided by DSL Extreme at dslextreme.com. Hi, this is Leo, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Saturday, March 24th, 2007, on the Premier Radio Networks, including our newest affiliate, WMAL in Washington, D.C. Welcome, and of course, on XM Satellite Radio Channel 152. This is show 337. Well, good morning to you. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. This is the time we talk about high tech. And I'd love to talk with you about it. Phone number is 8888-ASK-LEO. 8888-ASK-LEO. Or you can just dial 888-827-5536 for the alphabet challenged. And we talk about anything having to do with a chip in it. And that means computers, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, TVs, HD and otherwise. TV's the subject today for me, because I got my Apple TV. I was away in Vancouver doing the TV show all week. It was frustrating because I kept seeing emails and notices from people saying, oh, got my Apple TV, oh. And I knew it was waiting for me in that stack of brown boxes that I get every week. And there it is. I set it up last night. Apple is making a big play for the living room here with this. The idea, I tried to explain it yesterday to Bill Handel, the morning show guy at KFI, and I think I did a very poor job because it wasn't until about 5 minutes in that he actually understood what the thing did. Maybe it's hard to describe. Here's the premise from Apple's point of view. We all have a ton of stuff on our computers, video, audio, music, pictures, on our computers. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not really fond of sitting in my desk chair watching movies or TV. In fact, that's always been my complaint about the notion that someday, oh yeah, everything will all be on your computer. And yeah, but who cares? I want to watch it on my TV, in the living room, on the couch. And some people, solve this problem by putting their computer in the living room on the couch. Gateway, remember Gateway had a thing they called a destination computer that they would, it was a big old thing. Big old computer that you'd set up in the living room with a big honking big CRT, tube display. So this thing was massive. And then, it was Windows and it just didn't work. It's a bad idea. But people have wanted to do this since then. That's the idea. And more now, you're buying TVs and movies online, right? I know I am. And I think that Apple would like you to do more of that, if you wouldn't mind, in their iTunes store. They sell that stuff. So they've got a way to get this stuff out of your computer, and that could be Windows or Mac, as long as it's running iTunes, Apple's kind of music library program. Get it from your computer, wherever that might be in the house, into your living room or wherever your TV is, onto your TV. And it has a remote control, and you control it. And it's a good idea, right? We've seen devices like this for audio, like the Slim P3 and the Roku Labs. Well, this is for TV. Works with a high-def or enhanced-def television, uses HDMI or component. And it uses wireless networking. Now, that to me seemed kind of intriguing, both good and bad, I guess. Good because you don't have to run wires to your TV. Bad because, can wireless keep up with higher quality video? Wasn't clear, to be honest, till I got one. So that was those were some of my question marks. It's a little device, small box, kind of like a personal-sized pizza box. It's heavy because it's got a 40 gig hard drive in it. But I plugged it in and immediately was pleased at one thing. It's silent. You can't say that for the Xbox 360. You know, I would say that the competition for this is an Xbox 360 because it has many of the same features. You can download and you purchase, actually on the Xbox, on Xbox Live, you can purchase TV shows, rent movies, can't buy them, but you can rent movies in high def, download them to the hard drive and play them off the Xbox. Of course, you can put your music and photos on there. And if you use Xbox Connect, if you've got music and photos on another computer, you can, a Windows computer in the other room, you can do that. So this is the competition. But the Xbox 360 whines. I mean whines. It's noisy. It's not fun watching a movie. Yeah, and that's no fun. Silence from the Apple. That's good. Good start. Apple TV, silence. It is wireless using 802.11n if you've got it, B if you don't, G if you haven't. And, you know, I have to say that the networking was very simple. I was a little worried because I have an encryption password on my wireless network, but it handled it. I was able to enter it in using a little remote. Remote's tiny. Don't lose it. There are no controls on the Apple TV. You'll have to go buy another one. There's no buttons on the Apple TV. It has, you know, it's very simple on the back. It's got a power, you know, cord. HDMI, that's the high def video interface. And a component connector. Component video. It's got optical audio out and then analog audio out. And that's it on the back. There are no buttons. So you need the remote. I turned it on. I pressed, menu on the remote. Set up fairly quickly. Saw my network. I was able to join the network. Enter the password in. Then the next step is you have to kind of attach it to the iTunes. And you've got to be running iTunes. This thing only sees iTunes. That's all. So you have to be running on iTunes on your Windows or Mac or whatever else you're running so that you can see it. And then it gives you a little key, you know, like a 5-digit code that you have to enter into the iTunes. And you have a choice. You can stream the video, audio, pictures off the iTunes over the wireless network, or you can sync it because it's got a 40-gig hard drive. You can copy files over to the Apple TV. I tried it both ways. Syncing takes a while. These are big files, and you're copying over wireless. It's still syncing. It's been syncing all night. But I don't know if you need to sync because the streaming worked great. I was able to stream high-def movies. Well, okay. Apple's definition of high-def. 720p movies, TV shows. Now, I have to say, I'm playing it back on a 50-inch high-def TV, a Pioneer Plasma, pretty good TV. And the quality is okay, adequate, not great. You'll notice that it's not quite high-def. It's not even as good as the Xbox 360 video. The TV shows I download on the Xbox are marginally better. Even the, you know, just the I guess they're 480p. They're marginally better than these on the Apple. And that may just be the way that the stuff's coming in on iTunes, remember, because it's whatever Apple's selling it as. And I think that they've upgraded the quality, actually. They upgraded it in January anyway. Older stuff really looks bad. Hey, but it works. You can browse the computers, any of the computers in the house, one at a time. You can't do them all. You pick the computer that you're going to look at. You browse through it. You play the TV show. It's, on the plus side, silent, very easy to use. I think that that's important. It's a consumer device, clearly. It works, and it works well over the streaming. I didn't find any. There were no stutters, and I was using the network, too, for other stuff, and it worked fine. There's plenty of bandwidth, even on off of the old 802.11b computers. There was plenty of bandwidth to watch the video, which shows how heavily it's compressed. And that's the negative. The quality is not great. Another negative you'd expect, but you cannot buy stuff on it. You have to go back to your computer to buy or add new content. There's no way to add content to this device except syncing it to a computer. But I think what you're really seeing, and this is to me why it's an important product, what you're really seeing is a pretty good approximation of the device that we need to get our stuff off the computer. It finally, you know, they've been talking about convergence. They've been talking about convergence since 1990, I think. That was the idea that computer technology would converge with home entertainment. It would all become one. I mean, I'm not kidding. Since CD-ROMs started coming out, about 1990. That's when people started using that word. Here we are 17 years later, and this is really the first real convergence I've seen that works. So I'd say 4 out of 5 stars. It's a good product. If you're an Apple person, you know, already have Macintoshes, or if you use iTunes heavily, most importantly, if you're buying TV shows or movies from the iTunes store, this is very convenient. I don't watch TV on the cable. I only watch either DVDs or downloaded TV shows and movies. So this works for me. I think this is the future, frankly. Now, there are other products in this category from Netgear and D-Link, more complicated but more powerful, and I will review those down the road. Analysts agree. Walt Mossberg in the Wall Street Journal gave it a rave review. Kind of a controversy there, actually. Walt is an Apple lover. There's no question about it. He said very positive things about Macs. In fact, I think he called the iMac the best computer he's ever used. Apple loves him. Apparently, he loves Apple. Now, he's supposed to be an independent journalist, Wall Street Journal. He's very credible, probably the most powerful technology journalist in the country. But Apple obviously gives him special treatment because he had that Apple TV 11 days ago. Not even David Pogue from the New York Times, who is also, by the way, a Mac fan, not even the New York Times got it ahead of time. David finally came out with his review a couple of days ago. He might have gotten a day ahead of time, but Walt got it before anybody else did. And some people looking at that saying, well, I don't know. That's not right, Apple. And in fact, it's bad. From my point of view, it's a bad idea for Apple to do that, because now we have to say, well, I guess Walt's in Apple's pocket, isn't he? Maybe we'll have to take it with a grain of salt, anything he says about Macs from now on. If I were Walt, I might have said, that's not a good idea. I'm the only one who has it? That's not a good idea. Hey, let's talk about tech. Lots more to talk about. Is Vonage going to be around much longer? A court said you've got to give up those patents. You can no longer use a Verizon technology. That could put Vonage out of business. Let's talk about it. 888-ASK-LEO. 888-ASK-LEO. It's your turn to talk high tech with me, Leo Laporte. I am the tech guy. Leo Laporte from the Tech Guy Labs, beautiful Silicon Valley. I am the Tech Guy. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. I forgot to mention maybe one of the most important things about the Apple TV from the point of view of podcasters. There's a podcast menu on there. And I think actually that's really important for people like Ask a Ninja, Tiki Bar TV, Mac Break, the video podcast I do. A lot of video podcasters are saying, wow, now we are on parity with network television shows. And I think, you know, certainly the video podcast that I'm part of, we're going to make special Apple TV versions of all of our podcasts. So they'll be the highest possible resolution that Apple TV can handle. So in a way, I mean, that's part of the revolution, isn't it? Is making video content of all kinds accessible, easy to get to. Even if it's not from a network or a motion picture studio, it levels the playing field, and I like that. Apple, once again, has done a very good thing for people who want to create their own content, for podcasters, people like that. Let's go right to the phones. Line one, go ahead. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Hello?
Hi, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Rhode Island. My name's Ed Hinkle.
Hey, Ed, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
My old stomping grounds, grew up in Providence.
Really?
Yeah.
Just 20 minutes out of Providence, North Smithfield.
Keep listening. We're working on getting the show in the Providence area.
That would be wonderful.
Yes.
It's very difficult to have to wait for it on the podcast.
I bet it is, especially since I'm a little behind. I'm about a week behind on the podcast.
Yeah, it's okay. I can wait. It just takes a long time.
We just put a couple out, and I'll put a couple more. One more today and one more tomorrow. So it'll be fine. It's going to be okay.
Terrific.
So what can I do for you, Ed?
Well, I I've got a question. It's about basically Outlook on a Macintosh.
Yeah.
And
there is no Outlook on the Macintosh, but okay, go ahead.
Well, there was an Outlook on the Macintosh.
Yeah, it's Entourage is what Microsoft. Yeah.
Yeah. But now here's my dilemma, though. What I have is an older Mac that had Outlook and used Outlook on OS 9.
Right.
And I have a lot of files. Sort of like the PSP files on a Windows environment.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of files that I'd like to get out and be able to access through anything. And Entourage, I assume, would be the way to go. And I have found no way to get from Mac Outlook old files, mail files, into anything current.
Even Entourage won't read it?
No.
Oh, man.
And, It's really odd.
That's ridiculous that Microsoft doesn't read its own darn files. Outlook's notorious from this, by the way.
I know, and I have a friend who's got the same dilemma, who's really, really uptight about it. But I've got an archive file that I can no longer get to because now I can't even run Classic, which was the way to go to those files.
Right.
Up to a point was to run Classic on an older machine.
So you have no way to.
I can't believe somebody hasn't come up with a way to pull these files out. They've done it. There's a million ways that someone can take files off of a Windows machine, a PSP file, and put it into the Mac.
Right.
And that's what I keep coming up with when I do my searches. But I've found nothing. And I was hoping if there's any chance that somebody out there knows of a way.
So you're saying Outlook, not Outlook Express.
That's correct. I'm looking for Outlook mail files from the old days. That used to run only on OS, or does only run on OS 9.
Do you have the files? I mean,
I have it. It's one big file, is what it is—a gigantic file that you name when you set up your mail system. And if I bring that file into an OS 9 environment, and I open Outlook and I bring it up, I've got all the access to all those files. Now it's just that one file, but nobody else that I know of knows what that file is. I don't even know what file type it is.
The Outlook. It's an Outlook.pst, though.
It's not a PST file.
Oh, it's what is the file extension?
I don't know. I don't think
it may not have an extension because it's a Mac. Yeah. What you need is it would help for me if I could maybe do some research for you if you could find out the type and creator. Do you know about that on the Macintosh? Instead of extensions.
I do. Unfortunately, I'm not in front of my machine to be able to check it, though.
Send me an email. There's a contact link on techguylabs.com. And if you could send me the type and creator, I will look for an importer that can handle that. You got to blame Microsoft. They were very, and they still are to some degree, tight-fisted about their file formats. And this is, it's an important thing to keep in mind. It's not just you, Ed. It's going to be everybody. If we use proprietary file formats, when the company decides to make a change, or in this case, it's not only that Microsoft stopped making Outlook, but Apple stopped making OS 9. But it's going to happen to all of us for all of our data files, even our DVD files. I mean, times change, and these platforms no longer available, the software is no longer available, and if you're storing these things in opaque, proprietary file formats, you're never going to get them back. So it's really important to keep this in mind, and you keep an eye on your file formats, and export when you can, and frankly, for email, I strongly recommend using programs that support standard email file formats. Like, there's one that is a standard on Unix. It's called the MBOX, MBOX format. Thunderbird supports it on all platforms. Almost all Unix programs use it. Unfortunately, Apple Mail does not use it. I think Eudora uses it. If you're in that format, then you're never at a loss, right? Same thing for calendars. There's an ICS file format. iCal does use that on the Mac. That's a standard that anything can import because it's not Apple's. It's a standard. It's an open standard. It's well known. It's understood. And that's what you need to do. You need to find those open standards and stick with them. Ed, send me an email. I'll do my best to do the research. Maybe we can get the answer for you. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
Medicine, I'll be strong.
Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Northern California. I am Leo Laborde, the Tech Guy, and we've missed her for the last couple of weeks, but she's back. My former co-host from Call for Help. She is currently an anchor for City News International in Canada and has a great video podcast of her own called Command N. It's commandn.tv. You can catch her at ambermack.com, my good friend Amber MacArthur. Hi, Amber.
Hey, Leo.
From Toronto. Yes. Spring is finally hitting Toronto, I hear.
Well, I wouldn't say that yet. I would say we've been teased with spring. It's going to come soon, but there's been snow now and again, so it's not full on spring yet. But we're praying for some spring pretty soon. California is pretty nice.
It's gorgeous here right now. Yeah, one of the things that I rely on Amber for, and she's so really great for, is she is kind of a bellwether. She is. The canary in the mine. She knows all the time what's going on in the web world. And I just, periodically, pretty much weekly, I'll say, Amber, what's new? What's happening? What's going on? Now, you were on MySpace. You kind of got me on MySpace. But you say it's over.
Yeah, well, you know, I think MySpace is coming to its end. And I did get you on MySpace a while ago, and I was a big MySpace user and had, you know, a few thousand friends and still use it once in a while. But the past probably 6 weeks, I found that most of my friends, and even when I'm talking to, you know, people of all ages, they're really just flocking to Facebook, which has been kind of interesting that this has happened all of a sudden. It's kind of reached that tipping point. And Facebook is like a social networking site, so a website where you can go and you can add your own profile, all your likes and dislikes. The interesting thing about Facebook is that it started a few years ago at Harvard University, and it was exclusive to people at colleges and universities. And then it just opened up last fall, so anyone could join. But it seems to have taken a few months until it's reached that point where so many people are just running to Facebook and maybe running away from MySpace, and they seem to just like it better. And I have never seen a site that's attracted so many people like this site is attracting.
Isn't that interesting? First of all, I guess for people who, I mean, everybody's heard about MySpace. Unfortunately, it's in the news all the time, but more as a place where bad guys get a hold of our kids. It's not that. It's much more than that, as is Facebook. Can you describe a little bit about, for somebody who's never seen it or used it, what these sites are, what they're good for, and why people are into them?
Well, I think a lot of people end up signing up for these sites because maybe they don't want to create their own web page for themselves. So it's an easy way to go online and create your own page that has your picture, some information about you. So it's almost like having a personal site, but it's embedded among a bunch of other websites from other people. And when I say a bunch of other people, I mean MySpace has, I think, 100 million users. So you can go onto MySpace, create your own account, and then just kind of build it up and add friends to your account. So that means that you're really inviting other people to show up as one of your friends. And that's a big part of a lot of these sites. It's really networking. So really asking other people to join your network of friends. And when you say friends, you don't actually have to know these people. These are people who you might not know, but for some reason you've stumbled on their page in MySpace or in Facebook. You've decided you want to add them. And the idea is to kind of build up your network so you get more and more friends and your network gets bigger and bigger. But again, you know, people have kind of left MySpace and they've moved over to Facebook because Facebook, I think, has some better qualities. And as you know, Leo, people just get tired of certain websites. They get sick of them and they want to move to new ones. And we've seen that with everything from, you know, search engines to video sites, and it happens everywhere. And it's the same for social networking sites as well.
Well, now that makes me wonder, how long is Facebook going to be the thing?
Well, you have to wonder about that as well. You know, anytime you see a real rise in a site like this and you see so many people flocking to it, you know that 6 months down the road, they're going to be looking for sort of the new thing. And that could be a site like Verb, which you've mentioned to me as well recently, which is sort of a similar site to MySpace. And, you know, the thing I think that happens with a lot of these websites is that anyone who launches a site down the road is able to make that site better and better all the time. So the newer sites, the sites that get to be more popular, they kind of learn from the older sites, and they tend to have better features on those sites. And so people start to flock to them, and you always want to be part of something that's different and kind of innovative, and then people kind of flock and just follow the masses to those sites as well. So I don't know if you can ever really win in this space because everything is free and there's no loyalty really to any of these sites.
The Facebook story is kind of interesting. Actually, the story for all these sites is interesting because it's really just young entrepreneurs, or maybe even not entrepreneurs, maybe just young geeks who said, I got an idea. MySpace started off as really a way to publicize independent bands. Facebook started off as kind of a college thing, right?
Yeah, really what it was a place that was kind of like an online yearbook. So a place for people at universities, you know, as I mentioned, starting at Harvard, where people could go and then they could register their profiles online and you could write on people's profiles, kind of like you sign people's yearbooks. So that meant on Facebook, you could write on what's called their walls. So it's a similar thing to signing the back of someone's yearbook, but it's kind of a year-round thing that happens online. So it started exclusive at, you know, one university and then kind of spread around. And the guy who started Facebook is very young. I think he's only 24 years old now.
He was Mark Zuckerberg is his name. He was a sophomore at Harvard when he started it.
Yeah, 24. And then he dropped out of Harvard. He started this site, and now they have millions and millions of users. I think Yahoo offered to buy them for almost $1 billion. He turned that down.
That's what blows my mind. I mean, this kid's 24 years old. A big company comes along and says, "We'll give you not a million, not 10 million, not 100 million, $1 billion."
I know, it just reeks of the whole dot-com boom in 1999. That's all I think of, is that when everything was just, you know, inflated and people think that things are worth much more than they actually are worth. So, hopefully he will sell at some point, because I don't think something like this is going to last forever.
He might be
the
poster boy for insane greed. I mean, if it turns out that he didn't sell and that then Verb comes along and steals all of his users... he missed out.
Yeah, and you know, and then again, the users have nothing to lose. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Facebook. I really like it. It's really simple to use for anyone who's, you know, just a basic internet user or advanced, because there's a lot of features that you can add on to your Facebook account. But it's so simple and it's great, because whereas MySpace, I think, was about connecting with people who maybe you didn't know as well and checking out new bands, Facebook is really kind of almost reconnecting with people who you used to know. For example, I know a lot of people who've been contacted by friends who they knew in elementary school who have found them on Facebook. There's those types of connections. So it tends to be more people who you actually do have a true connection with than I think MySpace was. But again, there's no loyalty there. There's no reason to stay on Facebook necessarily down the road, and you can jump off it at any time.
Well, and you said that right up front, is that all the people you work with are using Facebook. So it makes sense that that would be the place you would go to, you know, why not go to Facebook if everybody else is going there? And that's kind of what makes people go to places like that. Is it also what keeps people at them?
I think it's what keeps people at them. And I think if they're constantly, you know, stimulated by new features on these different websites, for example, on Facebook, they have this thing called the mini feed. And what that is that you can see what other people in your network are doing. So you sign up for Facebook, you have an account there, and then you start adding friends and searching for people who you know. And then anytime they change their profile pic or add a photo or post on someone else's site, you know what they're doing. So it's kind of got this sort of almost Twitter effect. And that's the site where you can blog exactly what you're doing all the time. You can almost, it feels like you're spying on people in some ways. So it's a little bit addictive, because you can always tell what other people in your network are doing on their site, who they're talking to, you know, who they might be, you know, posting messages to. So it's added that other element that I think people really enjoy. It's kind of like voyeurism with a network of people who you already know.
I just think it's fascinating. It's just fun to watch this stuff. It changes so fast, so rapidly. Amber, it's always great to talk to you. You can catch Amber. Actually, Amber and I do a live podcast every Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time on TalkShoe.com. And you can hear that podcast at twit.tv after the fact. And, of course, Amber's podcast is CommandN.tv, and you can see her on City News International all over Canada. Great to talk to you, Amber. Have a great week, and we'll talk again next week.
All right. Thanks, Leo. Talk to you soon.
Actually, as I should mention this, we're not going to do Net at Night tomorrow night, because Amber is heading off to Florida for a much-needed vacation, but we will come back following Sunday. And what we do on that show, which is kind of fun, is talk to some of these people, like Mark Zuckerberg, the people who are in there making the stuff. We're going to talk to a designer with Verb, and my friends at 37 Signals, who are really doing some of the most interesting new web design stuff, have a new product they want to tell us about, so they'll be coming up. It's fun to do this. Now, coming up next hour, let's see, we got Steve Gibson to talk to us, and we're going to talk about Home Theater 2 with Scott Wilkinson today. But mostly, it's about your calls on this show. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's go to Brian on line 2 from Los Angeles, listening on the great KFI. Hello, Brian.
Uncle Leo.
Hey, nephew Brian. Hey. What can I do for you?
I'm trying to do a backup before I install my Windows Vista.
A wise man.
Well, I'm using Sonic. It's a new PC that I just got in January, and the folder, I put everything into all my files into one folder.
Okay.
4 gigs. I do the backup, and it's down to 3 gigs. Now it's down to 2.5 gigs. And I know all the folders aren't in there.
So are you backing up onto the same disk that you're backing up from?
No. I start with a fresh DVD.
Oh, I see. It's on a DVD. Oh, okay.
Yeah, right.
Well, this is the problem. Now, you're using Sonic, which is the old... Roxio has it now, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, you're using a backup program, and this is why I don't recommend backup programs. It makes it very hard for you to figure out what's happened.
Right.
It's just a big blob. How do I know what's in there? And you can go through the verification process. I don't use backup software for that very reason. I want to know what those 2.5 gigs on that DVD are.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would suggest doing is just copying, dragging the files over instead of using backup software.
Drag them to where?
To the DVD is fine. Just copy them over to the DVD.
Oh, don't use a program.
Don't use a program. Well, I mean, you need to use a burning program of some kind. You could use... I seem to remember that Sonic is a backup program that makes a big blob, right? It doesn't put the individual...
Right.
Yeah. If you just use Roxio, or you could just use, you know, they have the CD writer program, things like that, just copy it over to a DVD so that you see the folders, you see the files. You can even open the files from the DVD. Then you know what you got.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that, frankly, regularly. Like weekly, I will copy the stuff that I'm working on over to a CD and put it aside, and then I have weekly archives of everything I've been doing. And then it's not a bad idea to, you know, what I would do is get an external drive at some point and back everything up to an external drive. But now you want to do this before you do the Vista upgrade. A wise man, very wise. Don't bother upgrading, you know, backing up applications. You're going to have to reinstall those. Don't bother anything that you've, you know, got on disk. You're only backing up your data. That means pretty much your home folder, my documents, my pictures, my music. Just copy those over to a DVD. That's really the best way to back them up. Then you can see what you've got. You make sure it's okay, and you know you've got it. Leo Laporte, more of your calls coming up. I am the Tech Guy. You're here. Thank you for joining me today. The Tech Guy is brought to you, as always, by my internet service provider, DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GETNET or visit them online at DSLExtreme.com. Good people. They sponsor our chat room, too, and we'd invite you to join us in there. I'm in there, and along with 113 other folks. It's well moderated, so it's safe for children. Well, I wouldn't put little kids in there, but for your young teenagers, it's completely clean and safe during the show. Can't vouch for it after the show. I don't know what happens there, and I don't want to know. It is IRC, after all, but in during the show hours, it's safe. The chat room is irc.dslextreme.com. And if the channel, Pound Tech Guy, is open, it's safe. We close it down when the show's not on. There are other channels on the server, and well, who knows what's going on in there. Hey, a couple of follow-ups. I want to thank JB in the chat room, by the way, for giving us a link to a Microsoft product. This is for Ed, who wanted to convert his old Outlook for Mac files to something, anything, that he could use on system OS X, OS X. Apparently, Microsoft does make a converter that will take the Outlook file from the old Outlook for Mac and convert it to Entourage format. Hey, that's a step. From there, you can do something else with it. And I put a link in the show notes. Show notes are online, techguylabs.com. This is Saturday show 337. And to follow up with Brian, our last caller who wants to back up before he installs Vista, excellent idea. I am not really enthusiastically recommending that people who are running XP right now upgrade to Vista. I've heard way too many problems. Many of you, if you have late model hardware, will have no problem, but there are compatibility issues with some hardware and software. If XP is working for you and you know how to keep it secure, and that's a big if you're an expert, in other words, and you've locked it down, I don't see any urgent need to go to Vista yet. Vista is much more secure for people who don't want to think about security, and that's a good reason to get it. And, of course, if you're getting a new machine, you'll get it, and that's fine. I like Vista. But the compatibility issues are a good reason to think twice before you move. If you're thinking of moving to Vista, if you've got the disk, maybe you bought a machine recently, you should have at least, I would say, at least a 2 gigahertz processor. I guess a Pentium 4 1.6 would be okay. You got to have a gigabyte of RAM. 2 would be better, but gig is minimum. And your peripherals should be pretty late model. A good video card will help if you want to use the Aero interface. It's a pretty interface, but you need to have a high-end video card. 64 megabytes of VRAM. Depends on your video display. That's for a 1024 by 768 display. Higher resolution displays will need more video RAM. And then the other thing I recommend is to do exactly what Brian was saying. I want to back up before I convert it, because in case it's a flop, and I've heard enough people, including my buddy Chris Perillo, for the Locker Gnome, who said, I'm going back. I hate this Vista. I can't run anything that I want, including my Creative Labs webcam, my scanner. So he went back to XP. Easy to do if you back up your entire XP installation before you do the upgrade. And this is what I would recommend for you, Brian, is make an image of your whole drive. Not just your data, but of your whole drive, so that when you, if you install Vista and it's a flop, you don't have to reinstall XP. You just restore the image on top of Vista, and you're back to the way, exactly the way it was. The program I recommend for doing this, and you can use it for free for 30 days, so just download Drive Snapshot. I put a link in the show notes. It's drivesnapshot.de. It's a German company, Deutschland.de. That company makes an excellent imaging program. It's very affordable. I think it's 50 euros, something like that. But you can use it free, as I said. So it's a good time to, you know, now is the time to get it for your Vista upgrade if you're going to do that. Has two advantages. One, yes, you can restore very quickly. Two, you can do it from within. You can make the image from within Windows. You don't have to exit out of Windows. That's nice. Ghost won't do that. That's the other kind of big imaging program. And it also allows you to look inside the image. So let's say you like Vista, you want to stick with Vista, but somehow your data got munged up. You can, and this, remember, this was the thing that I don't like about backup programs, is that it's a big ball that you, opaque ball of stuff, you don't know how to get into it. With Drive Snapshot, you can mount the image and look into it and copy files out of it. So you can get your My Documents folder right out of that image and not restore the whole image, just get that My Documents folder. So I would highly recommend a couple of things before you upgrade to Vista. Get the Microsoft Vista compatibility checker. It's of some merit, some value, not completely useful, but it's worth doing. Run that. Back up. Make an image with Drive Snapshot. If you've satisfied yourself that everything you need is there, and then go ahead and do it, but just be prepared to go back. Kathy is on line one. Kathy, where are you calling from today? Hello, Kathy, line one.
I don't think it's Kathy.
It's Alex. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. Hi, Alex. I'll get to you, Kathy. Don't worry. You're next. Go ahead, Alex.
I was just wondering what you think of Myth TV.
I love Myth TV. Myth TV is a Linux-based TiVo, basically.
Yes. I'm a big Linux guy, and I'm just trying to get Myth TV working on my new PVR that I've got.
Best way to do it? Oh, you're saying PVR, not a computer?
Well, no.
You're building a PVR.
Yeah.
Best way to do it is NopMyth.
Yes, I've tried NopMyth. The only thing I'm trying to get working now is my IR blaster, because I've got Dish Network, and so I have to get...
You have to somehow interface with the Dish satellite receiver, and that's what that IR blaster's for. Yeah, I've never tried that. I don't know what the support is like in NopMyth, or Myth in general, for the IR blaster. Is it not working very well?
Well, what I've got to do is I've got to get the latest version of LIRC, and so that's being a bit of a pain right now.
Yeah. Well, hey, look, you know, this is, if you're going to do this instead of buying a TiVo, It's because you like to hack around with stuff and you like to play with it. I mean, frankly, if you just want a TiVo, get a TiVo. But if you want to use your old computers, learn something about Linux, do it yourself and have that satisfaction of doing it yourself, Knopmyth is great. K-N-O-P-P-M-Y-T-H. I'll put a link in the show notes. But be prepared to hack around a little bit. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my number, and I'm going to talk to you. Coming up, I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy from the Tech Guy Labs in the northernmost tip of Silicon Valley. This is the show where we talk about technology, and I'd love to hear from you at 8888 Ask Leo. Really should be 8888 Talk with Leo. It doesn't just have to be a question. It could be a comment, a suggestion, a criticism, a complaint. You could help one of our previous callers. I love that. I didn't realize this. Alex, our last caller last hour, was calling from the UK via, I presume, via Skype, which is, it was pretty amazing. The quality on these voiceover internet calls is great. Verizon says it's not going out of business despite losing this patent decision with Verizon. Vonage says, no, we'll be okay. We're all right. Don't bother us. I don't know how. In fact, the judge has now ruled that Vonage can't even use the Verizon technology. So it's really going completely against Vonage right now. Vonage is the voice over IP system that uses your broadband for your phone. And that's a great idea, right? You get a little box. It's a terminal adapter. You plug it into your cable modem or your DSL modem. You plug your phone into that. So it uses a regular phone. And you've got a phone number. People can call you just as they would your regular phone. And you can call them. It's very affordable. I think, $20, $29 a month for unlimited North American calling. And it's fairly affordable for overseas. Skype is cheaper. But Skype, you know, unless you go out and spend some more money and get some hardware, it doesn't work with a regular phone system. Vonage is about using your regular phone system. Naturally, this scares the pants off the phone company. They don't like this idea, do they? And particularly against a phone company like Verizon, although I guess all the phone companies now are internet service providers. So this is like a double whammy, because not only are you not using Verizon or SBC's service, if you're a Verizon DSL customer, a Fios customer, you're using their cheap data, relatively cheap data service to make phone calls and not paying for their more expensive phone service. They hate that. And I have to think that has a little bit to do with why Verizon sued Vonage. Sure, I mean, obviously the court has agreed that Vonage was illegally using Verizon patents. And I have to think that the court knows what it's talking about, because courts are so good when it comes to technology, aren't they? Don't you find? That's sarcasm in case you don't recognize it. I have to think that Verizon had two motives. One, you're using our patents, we want some money out of them. But two, we'd sure like to put Vonage out of business, wouldn't we? And then after Vonage, Skype, and everybody else, because we don't like it. It's bad for us. The judge ordered that Vonage not only pay $58 million to Verizon, but Vonage has now been enjoined, this happened yesterday, from using any of that patented technology in its products. That means Vonage is going to have to completely redesign their system. Now, the judge has 2 weeks to rule about whether to enforce the order. So Vonage has 2 weeks, a little bit of grace time, and the judge may then even give them more time. We don't know. Vonage plans to appeal. But I have to say, it doesn't look good for Vonage. If the judge says, nope, you got to do it now, Vonage is going to have to find some way of replacing all that technology. Vonage says, nah, hey, wait a minute. We relied on open standard off-the-shelf technology. In fact, we believe evidence introduced in court failed to prove that we relied on Verizon's VoIP technology. In fact, it's vice versa. This is Vonage talking. We think Verizon's using our technology. Vonage also says, we plan no disruption of our phone service. Yeah, I bet they don't plan it, but stock market doesn't believe it. Stock is plummeted. It's too bad. I really think competition and innovation are key to the lifeblood. It's what makes technology work. The phone companies have had a historic monopoly. They are heavily regulated, of course, but in return for that heavy regulation, they are protected. And that protection has kept them from being particularly innovative, I think. And, when companies like Vonage come up, instead of innovating to compete with them, most often what the phone companies do is they try to sue them out of business, and that's what's happening here. I like Skype. I'm just going to say that. I like Skype. I just bought a Skype phone. It's an SMC phone. It's an interesting package. It was $150. Then that's the idea of a Skype phone is it's the size of a cell phone. It doesn't have any cell technology, and it has only Wi-Fi. It's a Wi-Fi phone, and the idea is anywhere you can get an open Wi-Fi access point, or if you know the password to a closed point, like at your home, you use this. It has it logs into Skype, gets your entire Skype contact list, puts it in the phone automatically, like that. You can dial anybody, regular phone number. You can even, if you pay a little extra to Skype, you can have your own phone number ring on that phone. So it in every respect, it's just like Vonage. Well, almost every respect. I don't know what happens with 911 service. I don't think you have 911 service. But, I mean, this is kind of cool. And Skype is very affordable. I think it's $20 for maybe it's $30 for a year of North American free calling. And then just pennies a minute for international calling. I bought the $15 deal at the end of the year last year. I think for a month, they said, for $15, all 2007 free calling to North America. I bought that, right? I jumped on that. So that's a good deal. Now, I can't get the phone to work yet, so don't run out and get one. I'm not sure what's wrong, and I'm gonna have to mess with it. I have a protected access point in my home, 802.11g. It's the Apple Airport Extreme, the new Extreme, and it will not. I cannot get into it, even though I put in the password. So I'm gonna try it at my office where I have a different Wi-Fi setup. Maybe it'll work there. If it doesn't work with every Wi-Fi situation, that's not so good. That's not a good solution. The other thing is that's neat about this comes with Fonera's Wi-Fi access point. I think that may be the solution for me is to plug that in at home. Fonera is an interesting concept. It's F-O-N is the router, FON. I think it's a Spanish company. That's why it's pronounced FON, F-O-N. And the idea is, this is really cool. You set up, this Fonera access point. You can find out more about it, FON.com, in your home. And you have three ways you can use this. You can be a Linus. They call it a Linus. A Linus is somebody who gives away their broadband access. So you put in your router, you make it accessible. It's secured, which is nice. You don't have to worry about people watching what you're doing, and you don't have to worry about them hacking in your network. It has, it's designed to do that. But anybody who's walking around can see it and use it, say, with their Skype phone. And if you do that, if you're a Linus, then they log you into the FON system, and anywhere you go that you see a FON router, you can use it free. So you get what you give. You can also be a Bill, like a Bill Gates, where you charge people for it. I think this is very cool. I'm gonna sign up for the I'm going to be the Linus, right? Sign up for this and give it away. People in my neighborhood could use my access point. You should check, by the way, and I probably will do this too. You should check the... I'm pretty sure my internet service provider allows this. Some may not. And as they get wise, more and more may not. So it's a little easy router. You plug it in. Everybody can use it to make phone calls or just to surf the net. And then I can, when I'm going anywhere in the world, I can, if I find a Funera router, I can use that. Isn't that a cool idea? And the idea is if everybody does this, then you'll have this kind of Wi-Fi everywhere. And these things will be usable everywhere. I think it's pretty clever. We'll see. I mean, you know, it's always hard to get stuff like this started. You got to get a groundswell of support. But if they manage to do that, who knows? We could put the phone company out of business. Is there anybody who would mind that? I don't think so. Line two, Daryl, Mission Viejo, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Daryl.
Hello, Leo.
Hey, hey.
Hello.
Hey, hey.
I can't imagine that Verizon is the only one that's got any VoIP technology.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what Vonage says is we didn't use theirs, but the judge says they did. The problem is I don't know how sophisticated the judge was. You know, he trusts the tech testimony, and he decides, and I just don't know.
His last name wasn't Green, was it?
Ha-ha, that's the guy who broke up AT&T. You know, that guy's a hero. I think breaking up to AT&T was a good thing. The problem is that these companies now are... AT&T is essentially recongealing, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it seems like it.
Yeah.
A lot of people made a lot of money after they broke all that stuff up, though, too, with all the spin-offs.
That's true. There were a lot of... There was Quest, and there was... there were a ton of these, you know, SBC, PacBell.
And all the competitive local exchange companies who, I believe, used VoIP technology.
Now, isn't that interesting?
So I don't know why anyone didn't do anything to them. Maybe they weren't a big enough fish.
Maybe not. Maybe Vonage is more of a threat, frankly, to Verizon than any of these CLEX were. Don't
you
think?
Yeah, I would think that's probably more along the lines.
I think that's a little bit. Hey, we're going to take a break. You hang on, okay? Do you have a question?
Yeah, just a quick one about Vista. I can wait.
Let's talk about Vista. I think that's a great topic. We also have Steve Gibson, our security guy, coming up. Our guru in just a few minutes. Your calls to 888-ASK-LEO. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte from the Tech Eye Labs in Northern California. 888-ASK-LEO. Let's talk. High tech. All right, Daryl's online for Mission Viejo. Obviously a telecom whiz. Do you work in the business?
Yeah, long time.
Somebody says CLEX, I know.
Too long. I work for one of them, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed. It's really interesting what's happened in the telecom business. It's just changing very rapidly. But because these companies are historically monopolies and protected, I don't think they really are very quick to adapt to what's going on. Verizon, ironically, is maybe the most innovative with Fios and what they've been doing.
Well, I think as technology changes, it's just like having an old blender. Someone comes along with a better one, you know, 50 years later, I'm watching a different kind of TV than I used to.
Yeah, that's true. But I hate to see them litigate instead of compete.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, I bought a computer with a Vista OEM on it.
Okay.
And I needed to change it out so my hardware would work. I put my XP back in there. In the boot up, in the process, partitioning process, I lost about 20 gigabytes of the drive that wasn't visible any longer. Just disappeared.
Now, I'm wondering if that's the Vista partition.
Well, I had opportunities to destroy or get rid of partitions.
And you did.
And I did. And XP successfully got in there. But before I dumped a whole bunch of software in there, in case I had to reload, it's almost like it was a portion that I couldn't see to format.
How big is the hard drive?
320 gig.
You know, you lose some because of the decimal versus binary trick that the hard drive makers. You know, they say it's a 320 gig hard drive. But when you actually see the number of bytes on it, it's considerably less.
Yeah.
And you know that, right?
Yes.
Okay. You're obviously a technical fella. So just I'll mention that for everybody else. You know, the hard drive manufacturers always give you the larger of the two numbers. Computers really work in decimal. So a kilobyte is 1,000, not 1,000 bytes. That's the decimal. They work in binary, I should say. They're really, a kilobyte is 1,024 bytes.
Right.
So 320 gigabytes isn't really 320 gigabytes. It's only if you're in decimal.
Right.
If you're in,
but that wouldn't be like a whole 20 gigabytes.
Well, it's going to be a fairly large portion of it. I'd have to do the math to figure out what it is, but it could be 10 gigabytes.
I guess that could be.
And formatting also. But I also should point out, and by the way, you can tell this if you right-click on the drive, and it should express it both in decimal and binary.
Okay.
Vista does that now. The other thing that could be is that there could be... Who made the computer?
It's HP.
Yeah, all right. Well,
thinking BIOS.
HP puts a hidden partition on the drive.
Oh.
And you can with partition magic and other third-party partitioners, you can see it and delete it. I don't recommend it because HP uses that to validate that you are an owner. They put stuff in there that... including, I think, I'm not sure with the Vista machines, but including, I believe, the Vista install. So you probably don't want to get rid of that partition. Hey, you got a huge hard drive.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. Now, but what was quirky about it that made me call is I bought another one and stuck it in there, an additional one for a second drive, and the same thing happened to that. I tried to boot off of that, off my XP. So it's like I put a clean drive in with no OS and boot off the CD for XP, and it saw that too, which made me suspect maybe the BIOS is putting something in there.
No. I think now we are definitely talking about the decimal versus binary thing.
Okay.
I'd have to do some calculations, but that's pretty obviously. If it's a brand new drive and it goes in and it's still 20 gigs short, we forget we're dealing with massive drives now. So you know even. So what is 5% of 320 gigabytes?
Is that a difference between an external and an internal?
No.
My external C is almost the whole 320. On an external Western Digital I have.
Now I'm puzzled. Now I'm puzzled.
Well, all I could find on the net was something about Vista's boot manager, and then there was something about some type of hardware.
HP puts hidden partitions on. That's for sure what's on going on in the hard drive
that it came with.
I'm not sure on the hard drive you added. You know, you do have to consider the decimal versus binary issue. I'll do the calculations in the next break. I can't do it in my head. I got to break out the calculator. But that's, you know, it's 5 or 6%. And when you're talking 320 gigabytes, that's 16 gigs right there. Boom, gone. It's not really a 320 gigabyte hard drive. If it's 5%, I think it's something like that. That's a 304 gigabyte hard drive, really, in binary. But they give you the higher number. They kind of, I guess, a little misrepresentation going on there. That's all that is. I wouldn't say lying to you exactly, because usually in the fine print they say decimal binary. They've started to do that lately, I think, because people started to complain. I'm not sure what it means, though, when you see the same thing on a second drive. I think that's some of the, or why you wouldn't see it on a USB drive. Not, I don't know. I'll have to. That's one of those where, you know, there's only so much I can do by remote control. Remember, I'm flying blind here. I have to listen to your description, close my eyes, think, what does that mean? What could that be? And just and guess. Having been doing this for 15 years, I'm getting better at it. Another 15 years, I'll probably be perfect. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. I keep show notes online. Actually, I'm doing them myself, so please be patient with me. They're online at techguylabs.com. This is Saturday Show 337. You can also find there a link to the chat room, irc.dslextreme.com. Our forums, there's an FAQ, there are tips, links to our sponsors, and other Leoville sites. Coming up, Steve Gibson, our security guru. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. We'll be right back.
down a six-pack.
Oh. Leo Laporte, the tech guy from the Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Northern California. And as always, every week we get to talk to Steve Gibson about security. He is the author of Shields Up, which is probably the single most used security application in the world. Almost 50 million scans.
We're getting there.
Oh, it's amazing. At grc.com, he also wrote the ultimate disk recovery and maintenance program that really everybody who's in this business of IT, maintenance, has and keeps in their toolkit. It's called Spinrite, Spinrite, and that's also available at security around gsc.com. And he does a security podcast called Security Now. Steve, last week we talked about ports, and we kind of just used the term IP addresses, and people deal with IP addresses. They probably have heard that phrase, but I don't know if everybody knows what they are. Maybe we should explain it.
Yeah, I found myself last week sort of realizing that we had, when I began appearing on your show, Leo, we sort of jumped into the deep end of the internet, and I wanted to sort of pull ourselves back a little bit and lay down over the next several weeks, many weeks probably, some understanding of how this stuff works, because people talk about things that are like making the headlines, denial of service attacks and malware and zombies and email spam and they
IP
ask questions,
spoofing things like
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah. And they ask questions like why can't you find these guys? How are they able to hide? And all of these questions ultimately come back to the technology that makes the internet work. The cool thing, the concept that was fundamental in the minds of the people who invented the internet was something called a packet-switched network. The idea being that they talk about virtual circuits being a connection between two points on the globe that are both on this common internetwork of networks. I mean, that's what internet stands for, is an internetwork of networks. Individual networks, like a corporate network or a home network, which are then interconnected, and through this magic of packet switching, the data is able to find its way between virtually any two points in the network. The idea is that packets have addresses, and that's what this IP address is. People may have seen them around. They'll be familiar with them. Actually, I think they're sort of, you see them less these days than you do the domain names, but the IP address is that it's four numbers between where each group of numbers is between 0 and 255. Technically, that's because one of those group of numbers is a byte, an 8 bits of data that has 256 possible combinations of its ones and zeros. That is to say, from a value from 0 to 255 is 256 combinations. And so an IP address is 32 bits in total length. That is, I should say, a version 4 IP address, which is what the world is using now.
Now we're going to stop with version 4. There's a version 6. This is getting more and more. But really, it's like a phone number for every computer. And just as a phone has to have a unique phone number, every computer on the net has to have a unique IP address.
That's exactly right. And so the engineers thought, nobody can remember easily a 32-bit number, which could actually be a number between 0 and 4, a little over 4 billion. And that's actually the number of unique IP addresses that you're able to construct from a 32-bit number. And so what they did was they broke that big number up into literally byte size, B-Y-T-E size. So you have, for example, 192.168.0.1.
Probably anybody who's set up a home network has seen something like that.
Exactly, and that's where that number comes from. You put all those four bytes together, which are split apart by dots, so you have three dots separating four bytes, and that gives you this 32-bit IP.
So each now I don't want to get super complicated on this, but each time you get on the internet, you have a public, visible IP address that is yours and yours alone.
Yes. Now, what's happened is things have gotten more complicated. as time has gone by, there used to be a concern that 4 billion IPs, much as that seems like a lot, that 4 billion IPs might not be enough.
Well, there's that we would, what is it, 6 billion people in the world. I mean, you could see how you could run out if everybody had an IP address.
Right. Well, and, you know, if your dogs and cats needed them for their...
Well, you have one at work, you have one at home. How many computers do you have? And pretty soon you could see we'd run out.
That's a very good point. And, you know, many people now have multiple computers. So the idea was that there was a concern initially that we were going to run out. It turns out that we're only using about half of the total number of IPs even today, because what's happened is these local networks have been created that allows IP sharing, which of course is what people's home routers allow them to do. In fact, that's the way they're often sold.
Nobody really thought about the fact that, yeah, a home may now have three or four computers, but they have a router, so they don't have to have three or four IP addresses.
Exactly. The idea being that router has a single IP issued by their internet provider, and then it creates a sub-network, as it's called, that uses a sort of a reserved set of IPs that are never going to be used publicly so as to keep there from being any confusion. And the router is able to essentially, as packets leave from any of the computers within the individual home network, the packets are readdressed on the fly as they exit the router. It changes their IP address to being that of the router. So then the packet goes out on the internet, connects to whatever server or service that it has been designated to. When the return traffic comes back, the router recognizes which conversation this is part of, and so it, on the fly, it readdresses it to be the IP address of the computer within the person's home, which allows them to have many computers all talking and sharing a single IP address that's out on the public internet. It's very cool.
It's really kind of amazing that it all works when you think about how it almost feels like it's put together with chewing gum and string.
Well, and yes, and I really do, I take my hat off to the original designers of the system. They came up with, just by creating this notion of individual packets that contain the source IP and the destination IP, meaning the IP address of the computer that originated the packet and the IP address of the computer to which the packet is being sent. And then you have this huge confederation of interconnected routers. And all that happens is packets come into the router. The router looks at the destination IP, that is, where is this going? And it has a bunch of wires connected to it that just sort of pushes it on toward its destination. It's actually very much the same way regular postal mail is routed, where you've got a zip code and a state, and then you've got a city, and then you've got a street. And if you think about it, the post office doesn't send a piece of mail directly to somebody's mailbox. Instead, for example, if it's out of state, they'll send it to some large location, some aggregation for the state. And then the state will receive it and send it to individual cities. And then there it's further broken down into mail carriers who then have control of a zone. So this is very much the same way the internet works, using IP addresses as sort of a hierarchy of addresses, in the same way that postal mail has a hierarchy of sort of like granularity. And then, of course, within a physical street address, you've got who the person is in the house. And that's your find. It's like what machine in your house you're receiving the internet connection to.
It's very clever. It's really,
really cool.
It's elegant. And it works, amazingly enough. Steve Gibson is at grc.com. That's where you can also hear our podcast or on twit.tv, Security Now. We talk about these kinds of issues in great detail every week on Security Now. And we'll talk again next week. Steve, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Leah. Looking forward to it.
The way the internet works. Maybe that was a little complicated. Did you follow all of that? It is remarkable in its elegance. It's beautiful, but it's a little complicated. But when people mention now, when they say, "Oh, this is your IP address," now you know what they're talking about. Your unique, one and only kind of phone number that you have on the net. Let's go to Maui. Let's all go to Maui. On line three, Tom. Hey, Tom.
Leo.
Welcome. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. All right, now I've said it.
Thank you, Leo.
Yes.
I have a problem with streaming.
Okay.
I listen to you streaming on KFI because none of our local radio stations carry you yet. And so I listen to you streaming on KFI. I listen to you mainly on my desktop computer, which is a Mac G4, an old mirror drive G4. The connection is great. I get you. There's no dropping in and out. There's no buffering. It's just great. But it's only in one room. So what?
So you have to sit in that room the whole time.
I do. And 3 hours
that's a little
twice
much.
A week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little much. So what I thought I would do is take my portable computer, which is a MacBook Pro, a very new MacBook Pro, and put it in the kitchen. And I have a wired router.
Okay.
It's a hardwired router.
Okay.
And I connected it in the kitchen. The problem is, with that machine, I get a lot of buffering and dropout.
Oh, interesting.
It's almost unlistenable.
Same internet, too. Yeah. Isn't that funny?
Same internet.
And wired, so there should be no, you know, and what buffering means merely is that it's dropping packets. It's not, the data's not getting through.
Right. Right, and it just continues to drop it. And the frustration is it's a new MacBook Pro, theoretically more powerful than my desktop machine, but I'm having...
I don't think it's the MacBook. There's plenty of power there. The stream is not particularly demanding. It's the network. It's something going on with the network. And it may be that... Did you put a second router in?
No.
No. So you have a long wire?
I have a long wire.
Could be the long wire. How long is the long wire?
Long wire is 50 feet.
I mean, Ethernet's supposed to go 150 feet. But if you had a cable that wasn't well shielded, that could pose a problem. I mean, that's all I could think of. More of your calls coming up. 88-88. Ask Leo. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Tech guy from the Tech Guy Labs. 8888 Ask Leo. I'm thinking about Tom's problem. He's in Maui. Maybe the data just more relaxed. It's not coming to the kitchen quite as well because it's more relaxed, because it's going farther. I'll get there when I get there. I'm just relaxed, man. No, it couldn't be that. The other possibility, you know, one was on a Windows machine, one was on a Mac. He's listening here. Let me just recap for those who missed it. He's listening to the show on the internet. Cool. I love that. And the problem is, it sounds fine in the, you know, his whatever living room on a Windows machine. No buffering. Everything's coming in crystal clear, just as right as rain. But he didn't want to just be stuck in one room, so he stretched a long 50-foot Ethernet cable into the kitchen where he's plugged it into a MacBook Pro, high-end Mac. Certainly powerful enough to do all this. But for some reason, he gets all this buffering. Same network connection. Now, it could be because he's listening to two streams simultaneously. I mean, it may be that just, that, you know, because there's more data that's coming in, it could be, you know, one slowing down the other. I would try closing the other window in the living room. And it could be also because Apple doesn't support Windows Media Streaming, and so you've downloaded this Flip for Mac plugin for QuickTime, which makes it possible, but maybe it's not as good an implementation? I haven't had that experience, but that could be. Golly, I mean, that computer is fast enough. I mean, I don't think it's that. It's a good. Those are Core 2 processors. They're very fast. So, you know, one thing you might want to take a look at, there are a number of internet radio appliances now. It's kind of a neat idea. These are actually like radios. They use Wi-Fi, though, instead of getting it through the ether. I guess they're still getting it through the ether, but you're the broadcaster, not the tower. A number of companies make these. I think C-Crane has one, ccrane.com. Let me check. And the idea, it's really cool, is you tune in your internet radio stations via, it looks like a boombox. It's like a radio. I think it's a very interesting idea. Let me see. Internet radios. Maybe they don't. They have so many different kinds of radios. I thought for sure. A number of companies make these. And now, you know, you can go to places like Roku Labs, and they have these great devices designed for hooking up their Wi-Fi music players. And I'm pretty sure you could listen to the show on your PC and then broadcast it through it throughout the house. Oh, yeah, they make an internet radio. The SoundBridge Radio is an internet radio. So you can use that, too. So maybe that's a better... I mean, that's spending money. I'm sorry. But maybe that's a better way to do it. I've asked the chat room. I don't think they have any ideas. I'm not sure exactly what's going on. If you want to join us in the chat room, irc.dslextreme.com, that's the web address. And it's an IRC chat room, so if you have an IRC client, you can use that. But on the website, we also have a little Java client, so it's very easy. You don't have to download any software. You're welcome to join us in there. And the show notes are online. If you've got any thoughts for me, you can email me. I've got a contact link there at the techguylabs.com. Techguylabs.com. And if you've got some solutions for any of our callers, I always, I think of this as a communal effort. Because I'm frankly far too old to do this all by myself. Can't do it anymore. Line four, Taylor on the line. Where are you calling from, Taylor?
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I have a question, but I want to say something first.
All right. But where are you calling from?
Just out of... from the chat room.
Ah, okay. Where are you calling from?
Santa Ana.
All right.
Well, I am a G4 Rewind moderator. Do you want to listen to G4? Yeah, I'll just get you to Treston.
Pardon me?
Yeah, have a speech about G4 changes.
Oh, I don't want to have a speech about... I'm going to hang up on you, Taylor. I'm sorry. I don't care to talk about G4 particularly. I don't think anybody cares about this. G4 is a cable network. I used to work for Tech TV, which was subsumed by G4, Comcast. But that's old news. That happened in 2004. I'm long gone, long past that. I'm not bitter. Scott in Los Angeles. Hello, Scott. Leo Laporte.
What line?
Line five. I'm sorry, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Leo.
Hey.
So, with ITV and Skype, do you even recommend the wireless N routers yet?
You mean the Apple TV?
The ITV is the old name. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Now the ITV, or I'm sorry, Apple TV works fine with the Apple router. I haven't tried it with any other routers, but it works fine. Also, playing stuff off my Mini, which has an 802.11. G adapter, and it doesn't have an N adapter, so there's plenty of bandwidth even in the G. In fact, I think even in the B to play back the streams. Remember, these iTunes files are highly compressed. They're not big HDTV files. It's one of the reasons they don't look so good.
Because I know for a while you said to hang on.
Yeah. And it may be that this Skype phone problem I'm having is because it's an N router. I don't know. I'm going to try it on a B router, or I guess it's a BG router I have at the office, and see. And that could be, although that doesn't say anything in the documentation. I'll have to look. I think N is very close to being, the done. What you're getting now is 802.11 draft, N draft routers. And I think the most of the tech experts I talk to agree that this is pretty close to what will be ratified. There's some debates over it. There's some interference issues, according to Atheros, which makes one of the chipsets. They don't like the fact that Broadcom influenced the chipset design. Broadcom's their arch rival. But I think we've solved it, and I think N's working pretty well. I've been very happy with N. And the nice thing about N is it works fine with B and G. So if you buy a new router, I'd get an 802.11n. And I think, while there are no guarantees, that all the N draft routers that are out now, and by the way, the two I recommend are the Belkin and the Linksys. I've had good results with the Apple, but I have heard other people have not. So I'm hesitating on recommending that. But the Linksys and the Belkins are very good. And while there are no guarantees, I think it's highly likely that when it's finally ratified, and remember this with modems. We went through this all with modems. When it's finally ratified, that there'll be a simple firmware upgrade that'll make your new router fully compliant. Because I don't think it's going to be a big difference. That's the issue. How big a difference will the final version be from the draft? Draft is the last step before finalization. We should see finalization later this year. So at this point, no. If you're getting a new router, get in. Absolutely. Take a break. Come back with more. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. Home Theater with Scott Wilkinson coming up. Hello there. How are you? Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy from the Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Silicon Valley, right up the top, the northern part. Actually, I'm so far north, it's sometimes they call it Telecom Valley. But it's all here. It's amazing how this has maintained its kind of ascendancy as the focus for everything interesting happening. Now with Google and the Google campus, this is still the place to be. If you're interested in technology, I come to you every week on this station talking about it, bringing you stories from the front, as it were, and answering your questions at 8888-ASK-LEO. That's my phone number. Can be Tell Leo, can be Yell Leo, 8888-ASK-LEO. We were talking about Skype and Skype phones last hour. And, of course, there's been a lot of talk about a Google phone. Is Google doing a mobile phone? Apparently, no. According to Gene Munster, who is an industry analyst, Google is doing software. That makes more sense, frankly. Why would Google do hardware? Google's never done hardware, have they? Microsoft was a software company for a long time, and they started doing hardware, and then initially stumbled. It's a tough thing. It's a whole different business. But according to Munster, Google is building software for web search. Oh, of course, why not on mobile phones? And for location finding services that would work with perhaps maybe the iPhone? Yeah. When Eric Schmidt, the president of Google, was on stage with Steve Jobs, he referred to, and he's done it again several times, working with Apple. I think that's a very interesting space. Location-aware software that we're really going to start seeing as cell phones get smarter and smarter about where they are. And frankly, not just cell phones, laptops. Heck, GPS is getting cheaper and smaller. You could build it into everything, your wristwatch. Any device, your cell phone, your laptop, any electronic device could know where it is in space and then behave appropriately depending on that. Your cell phone already does it. It knows whether to roam or whether to which network to hook up with. But wouldn't it be nice if your cell phone knew where you, which actually does know where you are? Maybe it would be nice if your cell phone kind of communicated that to other software running on your phone. So you could say, you know, where's the nearest Starbucks? And it would know. I imagine that we'll see that in the iPhone. In fact, I'd like to see voice recognition. I'd like to actually press a button on my phone and say, where's the nearest Starbucks? And the phone would say, oh, Leo, it's two blocks left, two blocks up and turn left. That's how it should be, don't you think? It's got to talk to you. I'm sick and tired of entering in anything on those keypads on the cell phones. That's because I'm old. But you saw the Leno show, right, where they had the they had all these hipsters with the spiked hair. You know, and you know, the fastest thumbs in the West on their SMS phones, and they had them race against a Morse code operator. And who won? Easy, by a light year. You cannot convince me that there's any sense in entering in text. It's bad enough we have to use these QWERTY keyboards. These keyboards, which were invented in the 19th century and haven't changed substantially since then, that's our input device. That's bad enough. As if that weren't bad enough, now you want me to use 1234567 89*#, as a keyboard? No. And it just makes perfect sense that the phone, look, it's a speech-enabled device. Already the phone can kind of understand. Well, sort of. I could. It's fun to watch somebody try to use a phone to dial. Call mom. No, call. No, can't cancel. Call. Call mom. Cancel. Call mom. Cancel. It's really painful. But I think eventually, maybe soon, I hope, I'll be able to say, get me Starbucks. Quick. Quick. I need a fix. And who would be better to do that than Google, right? Just a natural. I mean, they're already, you know, they have a location-based search on Google. You know that, right? You could just put a zip code next to your search. Let me try it right now. I'm going to try pizza 90010. I should get New York City pizza places. Yep. I'm sorry, Los Angeles pizza places. Now, and of course, the very first result is an ad. Pizza Hut. That's not a search result. That's an ad. And you know Google makes money off that. So I think location-based, you know, I shouldn't have to enter that zip code if I'm on a cell phone. It knows where I am. I should be able to type pizza on my cell phone, or better yet, say, pizza. Pizza. Give me pizza. And the cell phone should do it. Anyway, apparently that's what Google's working on, not a phone. That makes a lot more sense. Of course, I'm the wrong guy to ask. I thought Apple was crazy to make a phone. We won't know yet till June, but I may be right. We'll see. There are those already who are saying, Apple's phone, forget it. Too expensive. You got to, you know, it's tied to Singular. You got to have a 2-year contract. And then there are those, including some financial analysts, who say this is going to be a bigger seller than anybody even imagines. What do you think? Are you in the market? Apple's doing some interesting things. They're really branching out from computers. They dropped computers from their name. They're trying to be a consumer electronics company. And you know who's failed at this? Who was the big consumer electronics company 10 years ago? When you bought a TV or a radio or any you know, a recorder, a stereo, Sony. Sony was the big player, and they fumbled this business completely. Completely just lost it. And so it's I think it's ripe for somebody to step in. Samsung and LG have tried in the television space, have done pretty well, but they haven't really seemed to really capture consumers' attention in the way that Apple has. Apple's is the Sony of this decade, don't you think? And that's I'm sure, what Steve Jobs is thinking. Talked about Apple TV at the beginning of the show and with the iPhone. I mean, it's not about computers for him anymore. Back to the phones we go. 8888 Ask Leo if you'd like to talk about it. That's 888-827-5536. Line 1, Greg El Segundo. Hello, Greg. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Hey,
love
Greg.
The show.
Thank you.
Calling from El Segundo.
Okay.
Listen, I've got a Motorola MPX 220 phone and it won't pair with my laptop or my HS850 earpiece, and I get this error that says Bluetooth hardware not found on this device.
Oh.
On the MPX 220. So is that a defect on Motorola's part of this on this phone?
Well, you never know. Who's the carrier? Is it Verizon or is AT&T?
It's T-Mobile. I use T-Mobile, but it was originally a singular phone,
right?
And it's been unlocked so that I can use it with T-Mobile.
Well, if it's completely unlocked, I'm a fan of unlocked phones because generally then all of the Bluetooth features are enabled. Singular's not too bad about this. Verizon's notorious about locking down, you know, Bluetooth capabilities. But heck, you know, nobody's going to lock down your ability to use an earpiece. So I have to think that there's something wrong with it. Either the antenna is broken or disconnected. Or maybe the Bluetooth chip is fried, but yeah, if you don't see any Bluetooth hardware.
Yeah, no Bluetooth hardware found on this device.
Yeah.
Can't detect my earpiece, my laptop.
Yeah, that's not auspicious. You make sure you do, I mean, I know you do, but I have to ask, you have it turned on, right, the Bluetooth?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know you could disable that on the phone.
Discovery on and off, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know that. And now put it in discovery mode and...
Still can't see it, then it's probably...
Still can't see it. And when my laptop is in discovery mode, it's searching for my cell phone so that I can use it
ActiveSync and have my contacts update to my laptop, it can't find my cell phone.
Yeah, I would say the Bluetooth is broken in the cell phone. I think that's pretty clear. And that could be a number of different things. It could just be the antenna. The connection has fallen apart. It's a fairly old phone. Might be a good time to get a new one. This issue of locked versus unlocked is great. And the FCC has said it's okay to unlock. It's legal to unlock. Here's the deal. When you buy a cell phone, you get a heavy subsidy from the carrier. You know, that's why, you know, it's $90 with 3-year activation. Because they know they're going to get you month for month for month for the next 3 years. That kind of, they can give you the cell phone below cost. They say below cost. No one knows what real cost is. All you have to do is look at the Razr, which when it came out cost, what, $300, $400? And now you can buy it for $88. You know, it's not, or less. I mean, these phones don't cost as much to make as they sell for. The retail's insane, and I'm sure it's a heavy markup to make the cell carriers look good. But nevertheless, the idea is, look, we're going to give you the phone cheap or free, and you have to sign up. And the way they enforce that is they lock that phone down. They say this phone will only work with Verizon or T-Mobile or Singular. And sorry, you can't, you know, use it otherwise. When they lock it down, besides that, they'll put a logo on the phone and they may disable features. This is very common, especially with Bluetooth and Verizon. They'll disable features to force you to buy other products from that company. But when you unlock it, or when you buy an unlocked phone, it's the phone as it came from the manufacturer, without a label, without a brand, without any disable. And I'll tell you, these are great. I've become a fan of unlocked phones. Legally, you can have a phone unlocked. The trick is to find somebody. There are sites that do it, usually for just a few bucks. You send them your MMEI, your identifier, your mobile equipment identifier, and it'll send you an unlock code, usually a variety of button clicks. And then you can use it with any carrier. These are GSM phones. It's a little more complicated with CDMA phones, the kinds of phones that are used by Sprint and the other guys, Verizon. Hey, let's take a break. Come back with more of your calls. 8888 Ask Leo. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Geeking out with me, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I mean, what could be more fun? Talking high tech. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my number, 8888 Ask Leo. If you have a question, a comment, suggestion, now. The chat room is so useful. irc.dslextreme.com. Land Doctor said he had a similar Motorola phone as our last caller. Remember, was it Greg who said his Bluetooth wasn't working on his Motorola? He said the only way to get it to work was to take out the battery. Maybe a hard reset to boot. So it could be, you know, I mean, let's not forget, a cell phone is a computer, and just like any computer, it can get confused. And sometimes you have to reboot the thing to get the darn thing to work. So maybe that's what's... Maybe that's what's going on. Anyway, it's worth a try. I always do that whenever I have a problem with a cell phone, and I seem to have a lot of them. I reboot the thing by pulling the battery, sometimes leaving it out for a while. Larry in Palmdale on line 2. Hello, Larry. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
Say, before I get on to today's subject, last week I had an e-waste issue, and boy, the show notes just took me right to the right website.
Oh,
told me right now. Fantastic.
Good. Yeah, well, that's really kind of a crusade of mine, because I think people don't realize how many heavy metals and toxics are in these electronic components, and people put them in the recycling or the trash. It's not good.
Well, yeah. See, my issue actually was a clogged printer, and I didn't want to throw it away because I didn't want to spend the money for a new one.
Oh, you called last week with the clogged printer. Were we able to get that working?
Oh man, did that website take that you put in the show notes? Took me right to it. Told me how to take it apart.
Yep, and a little solvent, a little alcohol on there, and
yeah.
Oh, hallelujah!
Worked like a charm.
Well, and that's something I've always emphasized. I may not be able to get it on the first try. I give you my best shot. But by the time the show's over, with the help of all of our listeners, we usually can find an answer to almost anything.
Yeah, and thanks a lot for that. This week, I'm okay. Still trying to avoid e-waste, but this time I've got I've got some important data on an old jazz drive and some jazz drive cartridges.
Jazz.
I used to back up with that.
I remember those.
Yeah.
I was watching Zoolander last night, and the secret data files were stored on a zip disk.
Yes.
And I thought, boy, that makes that movie look old.
Exactly.
And only a few years later, too.
Well, I think Zip and Jazz were both made by somebody like iOmega.
iOmega. You're absolutely right. Jazz was their larger disk. The Zip was only, I think, a meg or two. No, 10 megs. And the Jazz was what? Was it a gigabyte?
Gigabyte, yeah.
So what? So you have old jazz discs?
I got some old jazz discs, and I've still got the jazz drive. The problem is that it. I think it's a 15-pin to an SCSI cable.
Yes. The way these things would work in the old days, they would either be SCSI,
yes.
SCSI, or they'd be parallel. And I bet you that's a parallel. You say, is it a DB25?
Well, it was for a Mac, so I thought it was a SCSI.
Oh, it might be, yeah, because Macs didn't have printer ports, so it probably is a SCSI. So the good news is, in either case, you can get an adapter that'll convert it to USB.
Okay, and so the data that's on that is probably OS 9, and so the one machine that I have that still has Classic is like a G4 Quicksilver thing?
Yeah, I think that... Well, certainly you can hook it up to that. That's great. But I think that you should be able to read it anyway. I think that the newer OS 10 can read the old... Oh, I'm sure that can read the old OS 9 disks. It's still HFS.
Okay.
So you shouldn't have any trouble reading it. Now, here's the issue. Is it going to look like a mass storage device or not? I'm not sure what it's going to look like when you hook up this USB cable.
And so you can get that USB cable on the internet or at Amazon.
Yeah, if you
like
just
that?
Search for SCSI to USB. But the real question, and I think we need to find one. They're about $50 or $60. I think we're going to need to find one that makes it look like it's a mass storage class device. Let me look here. Adaptec makes a USB to SCSI adapter. Cross-platform, move the adapter. Yeah, it looks like this will do it, but the question is, what is it going to look like when you get that thing plugged in to the Mac? And if it doesn't look like a generic hard drive, it might be a problem. All I can say is try it. I'm going to look. USBgear.com is a good place to go for all of these things. Data transfer, I'm just trying to see. I bet you it makes it look like a hard drive. I bet you won't need any special drivers. That shouldn't be a hard thing to do. And if they didn't do it, they ought to do it. Again, this is one we're going to put in the show notes if somebody has some suggestions. Adaptec makes this USB 2 exchange that was specifically because Adaptec made these SCSI devices. And nobody has SCSI anymore. SCSI was the thing, remember? SCSI. I'm looking through all the specs on this USB 2 exchange device. It says, oh, shoot, not compatible with Macs. So here's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to, typical, isn't it? That means it's not a USB mass storage class device. It probably comes with a CD and a driver. So you're going to have to find a friend with a Windows machine, plug it in, get the data off of there. And again, this underscores what I was saying earlier in the show. We've got to remember these devices... These formats are very short-lived, really. If you've got stuff on zip disk, get it off now. In a few years, nobody's going to even know what that is. Coming up, Home Theater with Scott Wilkinson. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
In my life.
support the tech guy from the Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Northern California. And I come to look forward to these moments each week when we talk to Scott Wilkinson from the Perfect Vision magazine at avguide.com. Scott is a AV expert on HDTV. Actually, he's a video editor for the Perfect Vision magazine, so he knows everything there is to know about HDTV. And every week I've learned something from you, Scott. Thank you.
My pleasure.
There's so much. It's changing so fast. There's so much to learn. One thing that we've been talking offline about a little bit is the fact that rear projection televisions are not dead. There's all this focus on LCD and plasma, what they call direct view TVs. But for bang for your buck, you still can't beat RPTV.
In general, that's true. For screen size, RPTV is a great value. A lot of pundits are predicting that RPTV is soon to die and soon to disappear with the juggernaut of flat panels. But for screen size, it's still a great value. It requires a little more footprint, you know, a little more space in your home theater, but it's still a great value. And there were a number of things at CES and elsewhere that indicate that RPTV has still got a long life ahead of it. One of the main things, I think, is the proliferation of thin cabinets. JVC, Samsung, and others are coming out with RPTVs that are like 10 inches deep.
I don't know how they do it. I saw the JVC DILA that was 12 inches, and you could hang it on a wall. I mean, that's almost a plasma width.
Almost a plasma depth, exactly right. And they are claiming that you can hang it on the wall. I've got the JVC in for review. I just got it, so I haven't really had a look at it yet.
Now, I don't understand how it works. Now, can you describe how a rear projection television works? Is it the same as a projector, but it's got mirrors in it to bang it up onto the screen, or what?
That's exactly right. It's the same thing as a front projector, except that it's the projection unit is inside of a cabinet, and the light path bounces around a bunch of mirrors, and the image ends up on the back of a translucent screen rather than at the front of a reflective screen.
Isn't it reversed? Well, I guess they would reverse it in the mirrors or something.
Yeah, they would. The mirrors and the optical path and the engine and so on takes care of all that reversal stuff so that what you see is, you know, the picture that you're expecting to see.
I'm trying to draw a diagram or something of how you'd have a 10-inch thick rear projection TV. How could you even get the mirrors aligned right? I don't understand how you do it.
Well, it is a bit of an art, I'm sure. And there's also the matter of when you're bending light around that severely, you're likely to get what's called keystoning and other forms of distortion.
Right.
And they have to process that in a certain way. Now, one of the things that I saw at CES that was so interesting was from this company, Silicon Optics. And they make a wonderful video processor that more and more companies are starting to use in their products. Processing chip, I should say, and they introduced a new processing chip called the Geo, which is specifically a geometric distortion corrector. And they claim that when this chip becomes available in rear projection TVs, you're going to see rear projection TVs with a depth of 5 inches.
Wow.
now we're really getting into plasma territory.
But do you degrade the quality when you do that?
Certainly, if you don't do it well, you degrade the quality significantly. A lot of projectors, front projectors, have what's called keystone correction, and it corrects for this problem.
There's a little dial, and if you're not exactly parallel to the screen, you can fix it.
Exactly. But that does reduce the apparent resolution that you're seeing on the screen. And so I really highly recommend not using it, generally speaking. When you can avoid it, but this Silicon Optics has got a long history of providing geometric processing. They had a product once called Image Anyplace that would let you have the projector out in the corner of the room, and it would correct it very nicely. They do a fabulous job with it, and this chip is more or less that processor, which was a big box, distilled down into a chip. And I saw it working at CES in a prototype form, and it just looked great. So this is certainly one strong movement in this direction towards being able to have RPTVs that are yet even thinner than they are today.
Most rear projection televisions are using either LCDs or DLP or LCOS as their source, right? That's what they're reflecting back on.
Yes, that is correct. They're using one of those three technologies as the imaging engine.
Do you prefer DLP. One? Is one your favorite?
Well, generally speaking, I prefer the reflective technologies, that is DLP and LCOS. LCD has the problem of passing light through an LCD panel.
Right.
And when you want to block the light from a particular pixel, you turn that pixel dark. But it can't block 100% of the light. Some of the light, a little bit of the light, is always going to get through. Therefore, the black levels are not as good as they are with reflective technologies.
We talked about that last week on LCD.
Yeah, exactly right.
So DLP or LCOS. Now, DLP for a while had that color wheel issue. Have they solved that? You'd see a little rainbow in the corner. Some people, anyway, would see a little rainbow in the corner of the screen.
Yes, or any place where there was a bright highlight. And some people are more sensitive to it than others. I don't know of any rear projection televisions that don't still use a color wheel. But the color wheel has gotten faster, and the technology has gotten better. They've divided the wheel into more segments, for example, and it spins faster. So the rainbow effect is not as pronounced as it used to be. There are also some other interesting developments in that regard. One is, instead of using a white lamp to illuminate the imager, such as the DLP, they're now starting to use LEDs. And when they use red, green, and blue LEDs, they can strobe them and do other sorts of switching on and off kinds of things that eliminate rainbows entirely. Ah. I've got one of those in the studio that I'm just starting to look at as well. I'm very interested to see how it improves that particular aspect as well as others.
We know what the positives are of rear projection television. They're less expensive per square inch. What are the negatives? They don't seem as bright. You seem like in most cases you don't have quite the angle of viewing. You kind of have to be at the right angle.
That's correct. Exactly right. Some of them can be mighty bright. Some of them you need to put sunglasses on for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Oh, all right.
In some cases. But generally speaking, the viewing angle is one of the most important and difficult things to solve. The screen is made in such a way that when you move off axis, the brightness falls off and so on. It's also particularly bad when you're moving up and down. So if you're sitting down, it looks one way, and you're standing up, there's a phenomenon called hot spotting, which when you have a single lamp, very often if the optical path isn't designed well, you'll see the center of the screen or wherever you happen to be standing looks brighter than the surrounding area. And that bright spot, that hot spot, moves around with you as you move around, stand up, sit down, move to the right or left. So that certainly is one problem that RPTVs have to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, for a long time, I was a fan of the Samsung projections. I thought those DLPs were great. Then I got a plasma, and I'm not looking back. I have to confess.
Yeah, as RPTVs go, I've found that the Samsungs are among the best. Their DLPs, they really look good. And so, you know, if you're going to go that way, that's certainly one way to do it. I just wanted to mention one other quick thing. At CES, we saw Panasonic showed something very interesting. Normally, these lamps that go in to these RPTVs and make the light that shines off the imager last 2, 3, 4, 5,000 hours, something like that, and then you have to replace them for several hundred bucks.
Yeah, big deal.
And that's not something that people talk about very often. And I, in my reviews, always specify the lamp life that the manufacturer recommends or suggests and how much it's going to cost to replace it. Mm-hmm. At Panasonic's press conference, they introduced a rear projection TV with a new type of lamp, which is going to last. It's only going to lose 20% of its brightness over 25,000 hours. So it's a white light, and it still needs a color wheel, or in the case of an LCD TV, it doesn't need a color wheel. LCD and LCOS use three different imagers, one for red, one for green, and one for blue, so you don't have that color wheel rainbow problem at all. But still, they have the lamp problem. It's going to only last a few thousand hours. This thing lasts at least 25,000 hours and looks to be another element in the life extension of rear projection televisions.
That's good news. So you should look for. Are they in TVs yet?
The Panasonic models are going to be out, I believe, late spring, early summer. Those will be the first ones, and I'm hoping to see other manufacturers use this lamp. It's from a company called Luxim, and the lamp is called Li-Fi, L-I-F-I.
Yeah, that'll be easy to remember, as in Wi-Fi.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So look for a Li-Fi television if you're going to buy a rear projection, because you'll get
more. That would be one thing to look for, certainly.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. As always, a real pleasure. I've learned again. I've learned a lot from Scott Wilkinson. You can read more of his work. He's the video editor for the Perfect Vision magazine in newsstands everywhere or online for free at avguide.com. And Scott joins us every week to talk about HDTV. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Love to hear from you. If there's a topic you'd like us to cover on the show having to do with home theater, you can email me. There's a contact link, contact form on my website, techguylabs.com. And, you know, I'll set up an email for Scott. I think I have, scott@techguylabs.com. If it bounces back, then I haven't. I think I did. Larry in Palmdale, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Larry. Oh, line two, I'm sorry. Poor Steve, I don't tell him where I'm going. Hey, Larry, how are you today? Larry. Hello, Larry.
Hello, this is Rob.
Okay, I'll take Rob. I don't care. I'm not picky. Where are you calling from, Rob?
Leo.
I'm great.
Your show. I'm calling from Yorba Linda.
Great to hear from you. What can I do for you?
I am the IT manager at our manufacturing company. It's one of the hats I wear. And I have about 20 computers on our network. I'm using a Buffalo Terrace station as our NAS data server.
Mm-hmm.
And I've set up a VPN where I'm backing up at home. I've got a duplicate of that Terrace station.
Oh, you're a smart guy.
Daily backup.
That's the way to do it.
Well, I am running a Lotus Approach based database application. And sometimes, or most often, my guys are not shutting off the program at the end of the day, and I'm not able to make a backup.
Oh, interesting. So when it's running, you can't back up.
Right, it won't back up the data if the application is running.
Right.
It locks the file.
Yeah, right, of course.
And I'm looking at a way of automatically shutting down those programs at a certain time of the day. Is there a script or some kind of program I can put on each computer that will kill the program
timer,
at,
huh?
say, 8 o'clock in the evening?
Yeah, that seems like something that would be a perfect something for a timer. Tell you what, let's take a break, and I have to because the network is that way. But I'll talk about it when I come back. Leo Laporte here. I am the tech guy. Nerdy thing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, baby. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number to call. 8888 Ask Leo. And we're talking with Rob, who has an interesting issue. He's trying to back up his network. He has a good setup, too. It's a Buffalo Terrace station, which is a network-attached storage device. This is how the hardcore folks do it, how the businesses, the network guys do it. They get these big old RAID arrays. They're called network-attached storage because even though they're a computer, they don't have a key. They're headless. They don't have a keyboard or a monitor or anything. They just plug into the network, and then you back up everything to them. I actually have a gigabyte RAID array in the office, and that's what I'm backing up to right now from Infront. That's the company I use. But, of course, you still have to have off-site backup. That's why I still use something like Carbonite. And I'm sure, Rob, you do some sort of off-site backup. Oh, you told me you do over a VPN. That's right.
Yeah, what I do is I put the same Terrace station, a duplicate of it,
brilliant,
on my home, and I basically mirrored the two. And every day it automatically goes and compares any data changes and makes an automatic backup.
It's interesting that that software won't back up a locked file, because I know there are backup solutions that don't care. They will ignore it.
Yeah, but I'm running a small application called Vice Versa to do my backup.
Right, right. I mean, there are other applications. It's a Linux-based server, so you can also run applications off the Terrace station that will. And I wonder if they require it to do that. Now, there are programs. There are quite a few programs like, I'm trying to think, I think 12 Ghosts, that will automatically shut down software. You might want
to.
Yeah, you might want to get one of these programs, or quite a few of them that will do it, will reboot the computer on a timer, because it may not just be Vanguard, maybe other stuff that's running. Probably the smartest thing to do would be just a reboot.
Yeah, I could do that too.
Then you know everything, and there are more programs like that that will do automatic reboot. In fact, your BIOS may even do that.
Now, is there something built into XP where I can, just like you can automatically start a program at a certain time, you can automatically shut down a program at a certain time?
Yeah, you would think the scheduler would do a shutdown. You know,
trying to kill a process at a certain time.
Yeah, I understand. You certainly could do it with the Windows Script Host, WSH, and that would be another. That probably the best way to do it is to write a little script. Since you're an IT guy, I think this is something you could easily do that would automatically run as a scheduler, go through the various processes.
Right.
You want them to. You don't want to kill them. You want to have a normal shutdown, because you want to make sure that Vanguard shuts down and saves data and all that stuff.
Exactly.
So you want to kind of issue a close command. You don't want to just kind of, and that's why I was thinking a reboot might be a good solution, because a reboot gives everybody a chance to shut down in an orderly fashion, save their data, and then restarts the machine. Then you kind of have it in a known situation. I would actually look at WSH, the Windows Script Host. It's a very simple scripting language. It kind of takes over where batch files left off when we went to a GUI. In fact, they've now got this new scripting capability, even more powerful batch scripting. It used to be called Monad. I can't remember let me look it up for the, it's PowerShell, that's right. That is a very powerful scripting language for XP and Vista. That probably my recommendation is take a look at that. You can do anything in that, including SATA programs. Shut down, time to go to sleep. And you could run that use the scheduler to run a little script that would then in an orderly fashion shut everybody out. I think that's what I would do, Rob. But again, we'll open up the lines to anybody who has another way they like to do this. It's an interesting question. We've got, by the way, some great answers to a number of our questions, including the first caller right at the beginning of the show was trying to export his Outlook files. Bruce Brown, who's a Mac consultant, had a program he suggested called Import Server. John suggests an article that I've put a link to in the show notes that describes how to do that. So, let's see, Stephen, who's a longtime listener from up here in the Northern California area. He suggests a radio. C. Crane does sell an internet radio for Tom in Maui. That's a kind of a good way to go. Andrew's in Troy, Michigan. Hello, Andrew. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Andrew.
Hey, Leo.
Line 3.
I've been with you since Patrick and you and Patrick on the screensavers.
The old days on Tech TV.
Yeah.
I really got a lot of mileage out of that. I've been able to coast on that for years now. Pretty good.
So I'm graduating this year, and my graduation gift is a laptop, and I want to know whether I should get a Mac or a Vista-enabled laptop.
And you will do anything I say, right?
Exactly.
You're part of the Army. I'm not going to give you orders, Private, but we should talk about what you want to do. Are you going to college now, or are you graduating from college?
No, I'm going to college.
Going to college. So you're going to use this for college for 4 years?
Yeah.
What kind of stuff are you interested in?
I want to go into politics, but I just want to know. It's in D.C., so I want to know which would be safer.
Hey, good news. You'll be able to listen to the show on WMAL in Washington. That's our new station in D.C. Safer is an interesting question. In my opinion, Vista goes a long way to making Windows much, much more secure with this user account control. On the other hand, I think, the Kaspersky Labs pointed this out, people might get so annoyed by the user account control, they turn it off, in which case you're less secure than you were. I personally am a Mac fan. I like the Mac laptops. I think the MacBook Pro would be a great laptop to last you a long time. If you're interested in music or making music or making video, it comes with the best software out there for that. On the other hand, if you need to use Windows applications, of course, you can always run Windows on a new Intel Mac, but in general, it's better to run it on Windows natively. I'm gonna say get a Mac. Unless there is a compelling argument, for instance, if the school demands you use Windows, or you have friends who'll support you on Windows but would never touch a Mac, I think in the long run, not only is Apple more secure, no viruses, no spyware, but I think you get more bang for your buck. And you can still run Windows. Really, the question isn't no longer should I buy a Mac or Windows? It's who should I buy my hardware from? Should it be from Apple or Dell? And since Dell only runs Windows, and Apple runs Mac and Windows, seems like Apple's the way to go. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, I'm out of time. I'll see you next time. Come back here now, will you? Bye-bye. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear the Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.